Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task with the same resolution, the same sense of urgency, the same spirit of patriotism and sacrifice as we would show were we at war.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey, and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on March 18th, 2018, and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Rachel and Nate joined me to talk about the growing movement for teacher strikes in West Virginia and beyond, as well as the issue of anti-homeless architecture and technology. That's all coming up on Arsenal for Democracy. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me in studio again this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Great to be here, Bill.
And on the line from Idaho is Rachel. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on again.
So we wanted to talk about some of the labor actions that have been going on from teachers' unions and teachers outside of their unions in various parts of the country. Obviously, West Virginia is sort of the big attention-grabbing focus, but there's also been a lot of action going on in other places, some independently and a lot of it inspired by or enhanced by the seeing what happened in West Virginia. And so this is, I would say, a pretty big story for the labor movement right now at a time that a lot of stuff is not going right for the labor movement. So we wanted to talk about some of that and also sort of the internal dynamics of that as well regarding, like, you know, the union members versus leadership, that sort of thing. So, Rachel, let's start off. Where do we begin on this topic?
So let's start with West Virginia. So West Virginia teachers struck for 9 school days. They were waiting until a 5% raise for teachers, school staff, and other state workers was signed into law. I think there was some pushback from the Senate. They wanted to sign a 4% raise, but the teachers had enough leverage on their side that they really pushed for that 5% raise. The concerning thing is that the state legislature will have to search for places to cut. They're talking about tourism dollars, the state Department of Commerce. Some Republican state legislators have said that Medicaid might be on the chopping block. But I think the Democratic legislators will really push back on that. Something that made this so big and so surprising was that there were a lot of students on their side. A lot of students joined the teachers at the Capitol. Some students at Capitol High School in Charleston issued an open letter supporting teachers in the walkout. And
there were a lot of parents and superintendents even that were supporting this.
Exactly. So I think there was just a huge solid front supporting labor. And the governor, Jim Justice, credited sixth grader Gideon Titus Glover, who spoke up at a town hall in Wheeling, for broadening his perspective on teachers' demands. So I know Jim Justice did run his campaign with a lot of lip service towards the teachers. So I think despite switching parties to the Republican Party, I think he still kind of wanted to look good in front of the teachers. So he really supported the pay raise as well.
Eventually. It took him a while to get there. Yeah. But and it is, like, I think a lot of people pointed this out. It's kind of a frustrating situation. You can say, like, well, you got to vote for the Democrats if you want to help, you know, the unions in places like West Virginia. And it's like, well, not really, because A, they'll switch parties, and B, like, he explicitly campaigned on saying, like, it was on his campaign website, apparently, about, like, you know, we need to pay teachers what they deserve, and they've been underpaid for far too long. I think they're the lowest paid in the country, or at least the region, which was another reason that they had tremendous leverage compared to a lot of places. No one really wanted to go work there as a strike breaker, as, you know, like a substitute teacher strike breaker. So that gave the teachers in West Virginia a lot of leverage. I think also a big sort of narrative thing here was how a lot of this was being planned by the teachers themselves at the grassroots level and not by the statewide union leadership. And in many cases, like even during the process, there was a point where some bad compromise was offered and the teachers' union leadership said, oh, sure, that sounds good enough. We'll accept it and end the strike. And teachers in every single county in the state the next day voted, or that night voted no, they wouldn't accept the compromise, sort of flummoxing their own leadership.
Right. Yeah. I think this is the first time they've struck it since 1990. I think the union's leadership was really hesitant to draw this out much longer. But I think the teachers standing strong and fighting back against the union leadership really drew a lot of attention and showed the people power behind the strike. So in the Supreme Court, there is a case going on right that will be decided on in June. Janus v. American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, and they're going to rule on whether public employees in a union workplace should be required to pay dues to a union they choose not to join. So the public union is really in a precarious position right now. West Virginia is among the states that already has what's known as a right-to-work law, and teachers' unions don't have collective bargaining rights. Their salaries are set by the state legislature. So they were already at kind of a lower position of power. They didn't have much by way of official power, but I think just them rising together despite union leadership really was inspiring to a lot of people. So I think several states are now talking about protests, if not official strikes, among them Kentucky, Arizona, and most notably Oklahoma. So if you wanted to kind of segue into Oklahoma news.
Yeah, let's keep talking about that. I think Oklahoma is another one that's one of the lowest paid in the country, you know, after West Virginia. So let's talk about sort of the reactions there and what might happen there.
Yeah, so I believe they haven't had an official raise since 2008. So it's pretty dire there. We've spoken before about their tax revenue issues. They don't tax gas and oil drillers very much, enough taxes. They have a 3.2% tax rate, and they don't pay property taxes on the land holding those oil and gas reserves. So
I think the resources issue is sort of an important point in both states, West Virginia and Oklahoma, because the West Virginia campaigners were explicitly saying, you know, don't cut Medicaid to pay for this, you know, get more royalties and fees from the mining companies and that sort of thing. And then in Oklahoma, you had the teachers, I think, were running newspaper ads showing their pay rates compared to surrounding states and also the royalty rates for oil and gas compared to surrounding states. And it is quite low, even compared to the regional standards.
Yeah, even next door, the Texas tax rate is 8.3%. And in Wyoming, it's 13.4%. So they really aren't getting the tax revenue from these extractive industries as much as they should be, and even the neighboring states are. So it's really a stark contrast.
Nate, you wanted to jump in here?
Yeah, I was going to just throw in some of the data. I think in 2015, the tax resulted in about a $470 million break from tax money that could have gone to the state. And I think there was Governor Mary Phelan had a tax cut in 2016 of 0.25% that cost the state nearly $157 million for that fiscal year. And then combined with various price fluctuations for oil and gas, that's primarily what's been driving some of these underfunding agencies and lack of funding for teachers and things like that.
Yeah, per pupil spending in Oklahoma is the fourth lowest in the country. So it's pretty dismal when students see themselves as not really ranking as a priority in the state as compared to these giving tax breaks to oil and gas industries. Many school districts have gone to 4 days per week instruction as a means to save money. I think nearly 20% of school districts are on 4 day weeks. This has left some students unprepared for college. Nearly 4 out of 10 students educated in public schools in Oklahoma must take remedial courses once they start university. It's just really a stark example of how investment in education really affects everybody from the bottom up. So they're unprepared to go to college. They're unprepared to enter the real world at once they graduate from college, get high paying technical jobs. So they really can't compete. And they're left in low paying jobs. And it's just really a poor picture of our country right now.
So what are the teachers planning to do in response to this?
So if the legislature doesn't do anything, if they don't approve a pay raise by April 2nd, a strike will happen. Some school boards have already approved closure plans, which does help protect teacher pay. They started out with one day, but I think a lot of teachers pushed back, and so many school boards have extended it to up to 5 days. Oklahoma Educators Association has just not seen enough urgency out of lawmakers. There have been some bills floated, but the Senate was just short of passing a tax increase on cigarettes, gasoline, and gross production, that oil and gas production, in an effort to raise $450 million for a 12.7% teacher pay raise. And since there hasn't been a raise in a decade, Democrats said that even wasn't enough, that 12.7% teacher pay raise, just because they are so grossly underpaid. And it didn't even pass anyways. The Senate President Pro Tem Mike Schultz expects to try again. The House Speaker Charles McCall backed a plan this week to give most teachers as much as a $20,000 raise within 6 years, but no funding details were offered, so the teachers union just called it a political stunt to look good. There really has to be a discussion on how to fund these raises, because I know a lot of people are concerned as to where this money is going to come from.
Now, one of the other themes besides the resources issue that has emerged in both the situation in West Virginia and in, I think, Oklahoma as well to some extent, and then some of these other cases we're going to talk about, has been the health insurance issue, because not only did they get a pretty measly raise offered before the West Virginia teachers went out on strike, but the health insurance rates went way up compared to the pay raise. It wasn't even going to begin to cover the amount of money they were going to have to pay. And I guess, like, a lot of people sometimes don't think of it that way, but like the amount that you have to pay versus your employer has to pay, et cetera, that's all part of your compensation package overall. If you weren't getting health insurance, like, theoretically that money would be given to you as part of your paycheck. The more you have to pay out of pocket, the less your real pay is. And also, you know, the fact that we don't have a government health insurance system for everyone, and that we are on this sort of weird employer-based system for so many people, especially teachers, means that, like, if the costs go up a lot for the state to pay for their share of the teachers' health insurance, like, they have to pay a lot more, but they're not, like, that's money that's not going to the teachers, is not being seen by the teachers. So could you talk a little bit about the health insurance angle? I know in New Jersey that's been a big issue as well.
Yeah, teachers in Jersey City went on strike Friday after they and the school district failed to reach an agreement over the cost of health insurance. So in the members of the Jersey City Education Association, they teach 28,000 students across the Hudson River from Manhattan. They've been working under an expired contract since September 1. The union represents other school employees, such as paraprofessionals. They've been trying to negotiate a deal between the union and the school board for a long time now. The two sides have met to negotiate more than 20 times, and they just hadn't been able to reach an agreement. The union president said, "My 4,000 members have been disregarded and disrespected by the board. They're outraged by the board's behavior, and they refuse to give up or accept it." Teachers were asking for salary increases as well as a reduction in what they pay for their health insurance. Like you said, if you get a pay raise, but then your insurance, what you contribute for your insurance premiums goes up as well, that money is just quickly wiped away, and you're back at square one, basically. You're not getting any more net pay, and then along with, like, cost of living increases, adjustment for inflation, you're often getting a pay decrease. A judge did order the Jersey City teachers to go back to work on Monday, March 19th. We're recording this on March 18th, so it remains to be seen what is going to happen with that. And I guess we'll have to keep our eyes peeled for this.
Now, could you touch on a little bit this aspect of sort of differences between why it's like one school district in New Jersey as opposed to the entire state in West Virginia or Oklahoma.
It really depends on where the funding for schools come from, whether it's local or state funding that really drives where this education funding comes from. I know it varies widely state to state. So I know in Idaho, it actually is constitutionally stated that education has to be equitable across the whole state. So I believe Idaho is 25.3% funded locally for education, and 64.9% of that funding comes from the state. I know I looked up Massachusetts, and it looks like 40% of the funding comes from the state, and 55% comes from the localities, the municipalities. So there really is a wide variation on how teachers are paid, depending on the state, depending on where that funding comes from, whether it's mostly state funding or local funding.
Yeah, I think that is something that makes it hard to have a discussion between people, whether they're in the unions or just observers like us, to have a discussion across states and so forth, because it does vary so much by state how mm-hmm. education funding is handled. And as you said, it depends a lot on whether it's, you know, done by the county, done by the municipalities, done by the state. As you said, in Massachusetts, there is a large amount of money that comes from the state, although it's woefully inadequate, as almost anyone will tell you who works in public school funding issues and education policy here. And then there's a lot of like local funding through local property taxes. It's a very similar situation in New Jersey. In fact, the property taxes are so high in New Jersey to pay for, you know, the local education systems, that then they have a complex sort of system of state refunds or whatever, like canceling out the effects of the property taxes from the state level in order to try to mitigate that, you know, for the average taxpayers or whatever, because property taxes can obviously be quite regressive, and then it leads to an inequity issue, you know, where the rich areas have much better education systems than the poorer areas, because the poorer areas depend more heavily on the state funding as a total proportion, etc. Like Nate and I grew up in a community that, you know, gets some amount of money from the state or whatever, that's the baseline, and then supplements that, I think maybe double, if not more than double, I'm pretty sure it's more than double, coming from the local sort of property taxes. That does make it challenging to have these discussions. Although, interestingly, I think another sort of trend out of this West Virginia and Oklahoma stuff has been the role of the sort of grassroots intercommunication between members of the union. I alluded earlier to the fact that the union leadership was not necessarily in the driving seat on some of this. Some of the West Virginia stuff was originally just being organized in one county by like some wobblies, you know, the basically the more anarchistic, you know, radical elements of the union movement who were teachers, which is not that surprising for West Virginia, given its sort of history with going its own way in terms of unionism and labor activism, as opposed to not necessarily following like strict hierarchical structures, which a lot of the professional teachers unions in many parts of the country have tended to be operated as much more hierarchical. But basically, my understanding is that like they sort of decided to organize like a wildcat walkout or something like that, you know, in their county. And then they started talking on social media to other teachers in other places, and then started doing informational sessions and trainings in other places, and then sort of built this like almost like a, you know, multi-level marketing, except for telling other teachers about how to do a strike, was like, you know, okay, now you go and organize like 20 teachers to like attend an informational session near you, and then have each of them, you know, meet with 20 other teachers and whatever. And pretty soon it spreads across the state. Similarly, there's been a lot of discussion in Oklahoma, and the groups, you know, having Facebook group discussions about like, well, should it be just work to rule? Should it be actually going on a strike? Should it be one day versus other days? And I think that's also raised a lot of questions in people's minds about like what the role of Facebook, this private company, is in this. Like, you know, interesting questions from Matt Pierce, the Los Angeles Times reporter, asking like, just out loud speculating, like, is the algorithm affecting these discussions on Facebook as well? You know, for now, it seems to be tending toward promoting these strikes. Maybe the posts that are sort of more nuanced or longer posts about, like, well, let's evaluate all our options, those are getting posted, but maybe not as many people are seeing them in their timeline because of the way the algorithm works. But we have no idea because it's this sort of opaque private company. And then on top of that, I think other people are saying, look, like, Mark Zuckerberg has donated a huge amount of money to charter schools, which are generally very anti-union and sort of see unions and teacher pay as like the obstacle to, you know, kids getting a good education, in the opposite direction that the teachers are arguing, which the teachers are saying the fact that we are so deeply underpaid and impoverished is why these kids aren't getting a good education. Is Mark Zuckerberg, you know, or one of these other people, that a lot of the Facebook leadership, the executives are pro-charter people, are they going to suddenly say, you can't organize strikes through Facebook? That's sort of a tenuous way of doing that. But it's a way that many teachers have communicating with each other because, like, you can't use school emails, you know, the official school email for a teacher to be talking about union business and strike stuff. So I guess, like, that's been something that's come up as well. I don't know what we sort of think in terms of where that's going, but it's something, another thing to keep an eye on here, right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people decry Facebook and Twitter as kind of keeping people online and not in the real world. But as we've seen in this example, it can also be used to organize out in the real world as well. So it'll be interesting to see how other activist groups organize and how they use these tools.
The other thing that I wanted to talk about again, which I've been alluding to periodically throughout this segment, is the issue of like leadership versus membership on some of this. And there does seem to be a disparity there. And this is something also that I've experienced locally a little bit, which is that, you have to be kind of careful about, you know, how you talk about it, but like that there is sometimes a big distinction between what the leadership of the union is doing or saying versus what the membership wants in either direction, whether they're ready to settle or whether they want to keep it going or whatever. And then, you know, like I've gotten into situations too where I say, like, you know, I get along great with a lot of the members of the union and I support unionism like totally enthusiastically, but I'm not sure that I agree with what the leadership is doing. And sometimes I'll talk to people who say, oh yeah, the leadership really screwed up. Or sometimes you talk to somebody else and they'll be like, you know, the leadership is representing us. How dare you question them? And again, I'm not part of a union, so I'm just sort of speculating on this as an outsider. You know, that seems like a trend that we're probably going to see more and more of in a lot of unions, is this divergence between what the leadership is doing and saying versus what the membership wants. There were many cases in the 2016 election during the primary phase where if the leadership decided the endorsements, they would go with Hillary Clinton. If the mass membership decided the endorsements, they would go with Bernie Sanders. That pretty much was true in almost every case where you're talking about a big national or state union. Similarly, we saw, you know, in this, and later in the 2016 election, you would get a lot of cases where, like, the leadership was obviously supporting Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump. That makes sense. Like, Hillary Clinton's going to be better, so to speak, on unions than Trump is. But there would be some segment, not probably most, but some segment of the mass membership of the unions, especially in some of the more industrial unions, would be backing Trump. And, you know, there was some talk after the election about Wisconsin union leaders being very frustrated with how things had played out in Wisconsin and saying, like, you know, that the, you know, Scott Walker had totally screwed over the union in all the unions in Wisconsin, but that a lot of union members were gleefully voting Republican for various sort of like cultural reasons, racism, guns, that kind of thing. Who knows if that's really why, but that shows again that there's this divergence in some cases. And I'm not trying to overstate this like too much, but just that I think it's an interesting thing that's going to keep cropping up, which is now that we seem to have the means for the mass membership to more effectively advocate for itself and talk among itself, so like maybe we will start seeing a push away from this hierarchical model. I think a lot of union members in many unions feel that one of the reasons that unions got a bad reputation in the general public, although unionism is broadly supported by a majority of Americans today, that varies by year, but one of the reasons that there was this reputation problem was you would have, you know, the like the Jimmy Hoffa and that kind of thing, like the sort of more very aggressive union leaderships that were not presenting well in the public eye and not necessarily representing their members and kind of throwing their weight around in a questionable way or ordering members to do questionable things. And that's obviously talking about going back several decades. That's not like a recent thing. But I think that many sort of rank and file union members may start saying, especially if the Janus case goes the wrong way and the sort of union structure is devastated, especially for public employees, we may see a lot of these sort of more grassroots membership level things where they're organizing themselves. Again, that assumes that like Facebook doesn't decide to crack down on them or something, which is entirely possible. But we might see a lot more sort of grassroots driven self-governance, self-leadership in a lot of these unions. And then it's going to be tricky because you're going to be in that situation where you're saying, well, I'm pro-union and I'm pro-union member, so I'm standing with what the union membership wants. But then the leadership is going to say, well, you clearly hate unions because you're not agreeing with what the union leadership is doing. And the union leadership is the union. You know, and my mom's in a union and she has certainly disagreed at times with some of the union leadership on certain things. And sometimes she agrees with what they're doing and it really varies case by case. So I think that's going to be something to keep an eye on as a broad trend. Maybe I'm overstating it somewhat, I guess, in like the West Virginia and Oklahoma cases, but I think that that is something that's going to keep being a recurring theme. And then of course we have to watch out for the people who, you know, say, oh, I'm pro-union until it actually comes down to it. And then when they're, you know, when push comes to shove, all of a sudden they're, well, I think the union's making a huge mistake, or I don't agree with what the union's doing at all, or, you know, I support unions, but I would never want one for myself. That's come up a lot during the sort of media unionization wave that's been happening over the past year. There's going to be a lot of cynical people, I think, exploiting the fact that there are some divergences between union leaderships and union rank and file. Does anyone have any closing thoughts on this topic before we move on?
Just kind of related to what you were talking about, I think union membership has been on the rise again after many decades of declining numbers. And so I think that the average age of a union member is kind of going down again. So I think that will kind of tie into this membership leadership dichotomy, just maybe a younger radical rank and file versus an older, maybe more conservative leadership. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out in the coming months and years.
I think you suggested that there was some nervousness on the part of the union leadership in West Virginia because they hadn't done this in a while. And I think that's probably something that the youth versus elder divide in the unions probably contributes to. Nate?
Yeah, it seems like younger members are more willing to embrace wildcat strike techniques and things like that, and that's sort of been spreading around. It seems like Jersey City, there's also teachers went on strike, I think, last Friday. So it seems like the West Virginia strike is definitely inspiring people. I saw that they were doing some cross-Atlantic solidarity with British teachers as well in some areas. So definitely we're seeing the impact on a lot of different states and all around from these protests.
The other thing too, I mean, to your point about the inspiration factor, not to go too deep into this, but I have sort of a personal theory that I think obviously they were planning for many months the strike in West Virginia, and they've been talking about it in Oklahoma for quite a while as well. But the Parkland shooting and some of the discourse that followed that, a lot of it emphasizing like, should we arm the teachers, like that coming up again, and then people like a lot of parents and students pushing back and saying, no, that's not the right response. You know, talking about all the things that teachers do need money for that doesn't involve guns or gun training. I think that the timing may have contributed to like strengthening the hand in the public perception of these teachers, because they could say, well, look, like clearly you're going to, if you actually went through with this plan, then you're saying like, well, we got to have these highly trained teachers or whatever that we're dumping all this money into this guns program, but mysteriously we can't come up with the money to pay for their health insurance increases or their raises or whatever. I think that may have contributed at least somewhat in sort of like reminding people like, you like teachers despite all of the newspapers trying to, you know, and TV stations trying to convince you that you hate teachers and the evil teachers unions. It was like, no, you like teachers and you agree that they're undervalued, which is their sort of core premise underlying their strike, and you want them to succeed, and you're willing to let this go on for more than a week, which is what happened in West Virginia. And like we saw so many students rallying with these teachers and parents rallying with these teachers, and as I said, even superintendents in many cases, because which I don't think would happen in some place like Massachusetts, because in that case, the superintendents are like part of the negotiating process at the local level for what the pay is going to be, whereas I think it was sort of out of their hands in a state like West Virginia or Oklahoma. So I think that that may have also, the timing of that may have also contributed to sort of public perception on this, although who knows, really. There's a lot of factors that go into that. All right, well, we're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about the issue of hostile architecture. So all of the articles that we talked about, news links, that sort of thing, are going to be up at arsenalfordemocracy.com as usual, and we'll be right back in just a moment from WVUD. Please stick around. Democracy. You're still listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Still in studio with me is Nathan. On the line from Idaho is Rachel. So a few weeks ago, we did a episode talking about homelessness and some of the policy ideas responding to that. But we, as we said at the time, we were just kind of getting the tip of the iceberg there. Another topic that comes up a lot these days in discussions of homelessness, especially urban homelessness, is the issue of hostile architecture, which partly is designed to affect homeless people and prevent them from sort of loitering or whatever you want to call it, or just sleeping places. But also it has an effect on the general public as well, even people who aren't homeless, by basically discouraging people from sort of staying put in one place for any amount of time at all, kind of keep you moving at all times. Which has various sort of social effects. So, Nate, let's talk about hostile architecture. You've been reading a lot of articles talking about this because it has been a very heated debate for quite a number of years now. It's something people like to talk about a lot on social media. Where do we start on this topic?
Yeah, you mentioned social media because I was sort of inspired about this topic, just looking at there were people posting examples of hostile architecture, and sort of once you start seeing it, you sort of start to think about hostile architecture constantly just when you're in the normal environment, just like looking at benches and various other public spaces and things like that. And you sort of start thinking about, okay, is this an example, you know, and how so? And so a lot of the examples that people bring forth are things like sort of like unnecessary armrests, sort of like as a divider in the middle of a bench, so you can't like lie down or anything like that. I've been noticing recently also these things called SUFAs, which have been popping up. There are some around in the Cambridge area, and I've seen them around in other places too. But it's like, it's a bench that has this solar panel in the middle, and you can like charge your USB devices and things like that from the solar power. And like, okay, that's interesting that you can just charge on a bench or whatever. It I mean, a lot of these are done so that you can't lie down on the bench, things like that. And yeah, it sort of has led me into this debate over hostile architecture and what the sort of design responses should be, or just the debate around it. So there's a debate from CNN from about December last year, where they had two architects that went on and discussed with each other. One was more critical of hostile architecture, and one was more defensive of it. It was interesting. It sort of, when they were talking about different types of benches that are like in strange designs where you can't really lie down on them. Some that look kind of cool, but one called like the Camden bench. This was a sort of, a lot of this stuff comes out of the UK, and definitely there's benches like that in, say, New York too. But it's sort of at all these like weird angles, and it would be, you know, obviously uncomfortable to lie down on, but you can sort of sit on it for a little bit. But the debate sort of came down to, was one of the architects, and I think it actually might have been the one that's more critical of hostile architecture, but basically admitting the general public can still even enjoy urban spaces with hostile architecture because, oh yeah, you're just sitting down for like 5 minutes, but you don't need to stay at a period for a long period of time. And it just, you start thinking about like, this is extremely hostile toward the idea of sort of like a public or of a community where you can sit down on a bench and maybe have a discussion with someone or read a book for a half hour, an hour, or just like see someone that you know on the street and have a conversation. It just seems like a lot of this is designed so just you shuffle people from sort of place to place. There's no real sitting down or talking. It's, you know, going from these different commodified experiences, like you have to go into a cafe, you can't just stand around outside or something like that. So that's sort of the meta debate around that there. And there have been some examples recently of, so this was, I think, from January 2018, there was a bunch of bike racks installed to block rough sleepers in Seattle. So under this overpass, Highway 99, a lot of there have been homeless encampments, and the Department of Transportation, apparently, there was a public disclosure request from emails from Seattle DOT, and they found out that this the bike racks were put up as a result, like right after the homeless encampment was cleared on Monday, and then so ideally we'll be able to install behind the clean team. So first of all, calling anti-homeless things cleaning squads, that's pretty scary right there based on what that evokes. But and so people were basically saying it's like, yeah, this was just people trying to get out of the rain, basically. Like one person was saying, my experience with the folks that were camped out there, they were not a nuisance to the community. People have this impression of who is living with housing insecurity, but there were a lot of women and children taking shelter under the viaduct, people with pets, precisely the people that couldn't depend on shelter available in the city. And apparently they're actually removing a lot of these bike racks as a result of some of the public outcry as a result of this. So basically they were being called on. It's like these are basically whitewashed housing spikes, which has been sort of the most dramatic example of hostile architecture. You just see spikes on the ground. And there have been some efforts in the UK to remove some of these anti-homeless spikes, maybe outside of like a housing area or just like outside of a shop so people don't lie down on the ground. But there was an example there were some examples in both the UK, also in Montreal, where people were putting pillows down on top of the spikes. There was, putting sandwiches down as well, and eventually getting people to remove the homeless spikes just by sort of public outcry. And it's like sort of sense of decency. Like, we don't want all of our cities to look like RoboCop, basically. You know, this is not really how we want our city to look. And there have been also some examples of even more radical direct action to remove some of these hostile architectures. So a group called the London Black Revs, so a black and Asian a revolutionary socialist organization in London, where they poured concrete over the anti-homeless spikes. There have been some examples of anarchists removing with, you know, sort of like crowbars, the armrests on a lot of these benches, and sort of just taking it directly, just going out in the night. And it's like, okay, you know, this sort of hostile architecture will not survive the night, basically. And we're just going to do whatever we can to make, to sort of get rid of a lot of this stuff. So these are just some examples. I mean, there's a lot of it. And once you start seeing it, you can't really unsee it. And a lot of this hostile architecture also is targeted against like skateboarders, and people are just like grinding on rails and stuff.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's sort of the other main target besides homelessness is anti-skateboarding stuff, which I feel like that was what I like as a kid would initially start noticing before noticing the anti-homeless measures, was just like the stuff to keep kids from skateboarding around, because, you know, heaven forbid any American kids get outside for any reason and engage in any physical activity.
I mean, this is kind of just an example of just sort of the hostility towards the example, or just hostility towards homeless people, people facing housing insecurity, things like that. And also just, as I mentioned, the concept of a public where people just go out, sit on a bench and enjoy a public space. And no, this is very much like, okay, you can sit on this bench for 5 minutes and then you need to keep going. And we're not even going to build benches in some cases. We're just going to build these things that you can sort of like lean against. So you definitely can't sleep on them and you can't even really sit on them. You can just sort of lean up against them like at a bus stop or something. And yeah, there you go.
Yeah. I mean, that's been a huge thing too, like taking out benches or at bus stops you know, or making them very difficult to sit on, you know, like, because somehow that's a security risk that there will be a homeless person sleeping in the bench, you know, in the bus shelter or whatever overnight when people are waiting to take the bus. And it's like, well, I don't know. That seems like an extreme response. And it's also not comfortable for people who actually need to sit, you know, around for the bus stop the rest of the day or whatever, you know. I think that a lot of this architecture also probably negatively affects various people with disabilities, you know, especially if someone, an elderly person, for example, maybe needs to sit down and be able to rest their back against something for a while.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's kind of hard to do, especially if they don't, if there's no back on the bench, which is pretty common as well as a device. Rachel, we'll go to you now. What are your thoughts on some of this?
I have to say that it seems like Boise is about 20 years behind, on this hostile architecture trend. There's tons of benches downtown. There's tons of places to sit. And I think, I don't think we've really gotten those center dividers yet on our benches, as far as I can tell. But we do have a skate park under an overpass where homeless people did shelter from wind and rain and whatnot. And it was called Road Skate Park. And it just underwent a huge, I think it was like a 2-year remodeling plan. And in the meantime, they've added this huge like rock structure, sculpture, I guess, on both sides of the underpass. So it definitely has cut down on like the tent encampments that were there previously. And it I have to say, it looks really, really ugly. It's just hideous. I think the homeless encampment was much less of an eyesore than this ugly cemented rock thing. Boise has kind of shown its hostility to homeless people in the past. There have been a few encampments that have been routed and stuff thrown away, possessions thrown away. So I think we definitely are not immune to that hostility towards homeless people. I think less so towards skaters, in that we do have a huge skate park, and I have seen skateboarders throughout downtown Boise quite often, and it doesn't appear that there's been those like rail nubs or whatever, rail spikes to prevent that.
Yeah, it does seem like a lot of this is sort of emanating from these large urban centers that have had issues with housing insecurity. So definitely, as I mentioned, like Seattle, we're seeing a lot of things like that on the West Coast. Also, as I mentioned, London. There are a couple other examples of hostile architecture I wanted to throw in. Certain public bathrooms have been using, say, these blue lights that make it harder for people to find veins to use drugs intravenously. And so obviously with the, you know, sort of opioid epidemic, that's become an issue. Other places, I think this is more of a UK thing, but they put like these things that blast frequencies that only children can hear, basically, because I guess they don't want kids congregating outside of like a shop or something. But
yeah, I mean, the UK is deeply antagonistic toward its children, which I think has been a long-standing British cultural trend, but that has been like, they are terrified of these packs of children in hoodies just congregating in any numbers at all, which I think, I mean, sort of a bigger picture thing aside from the children specifically, is like a lot of hostile architecture, setting aside the homelessness issue and encampments issue, has been designed to break up large public empty spaces where people might congregate, because many governments are terrified of the possibility of people congregating in large numbers, because they might do it to protest and they might do it to try to overthrow the government. That's something that like developing nations for a long time have tried to like move away from, having these sort of large open plazas for like national demonstrations or whatever, because they figured out that eventually the national demonstrations get turned against them. And I think that, you know, we saw things like Occupy Wall Street happen and so forth in various developed nations, and a lot of them sort of panicked and started putting in more like, you know, weird sculptures and things specifically just to break up open spaces, because they're afraid of anyone, whether it's 14-year-olds or, you know, 35-year-olds congregating in any large numbers, because then, oh, they're going to clash with police or whatever, you know. And so that sort of is a related element with the hostile architecture stuff, I think. But, you know, as you were saying, in the UK, a lot of the focus is on children, because they're just terrified of these kids, like, you know, scaring the adults out in public. and then give everyone those ASBOs, the antisocial behavior orders that were pioneered, I think, under the Labor government of Tony Blair. That's sort of like become this TV trope in British TV, is people getting ASBOs because they did something that ticked off a police officer or whatever. And then, you know, now it goes through a whole court process because they were being antisocial in some way, which then implies that the government has a very rigid idea from the top down of what social behavior is. And of course, hostile architecture itself seems pretty antisocial in general.
Yeah, just going from the debate again at the on CNN. And so one of the questions was, I'm glad you brought up the homeless. Don't they need places to rest? And one of the people is like, I find it difficult to think why anyone would want to sleep on a bench. It's no place for anyone to spend the night. And it's like,
wow, cool.
Do you get it? Are you missing something here?
Yeah, why would they sleep on a bench when they could sleep in a house on a bed?
Yeah. Ever think of that?
Yeah, I think a lot of this, too, to Rachel's point about, you know, Boise and other places, and Nate was mentioning about these sort of major metro areas, I think a lot of it also has to do with the local climate, right? Like, you know, Boise's not that temperate. Places, you know, Britain has a more temperate climate than many parts of the United States, San Francisco, even Seattle. Like, those tend to be much better climates to survive in. Even Boston, you know, is too cold a lot of the year, and you know that can be very scary and potentially life-threatening. I think here this morning it was like 10 degrees or something. Like it can get pretty cold suddenly, and I think like Boise probably has less homelessness than many places because of that fact. Like people are not moving from other parts of the country to Boise because they know that it's a great environment to be surviving in. You know, and San Francisco, I think, has really been because, well, there was also the thing where Rudy Giuliani gave a whole bunch of bus tickets to San Francisco to all these homeless people in New York City. So then all these homeless people moved across the country to San Francisco. But, you know, San Francisco has a generally more favorable climate. It had been a little bit more socially welcoming back in the day, you know, when between the, you know, hippie stuff in the Bay Area and just the low income populations in Oakland and the, you know, gay community in San Francisco. I think some people were a little bit more sympathetic to people who had run out of options in life and were being, you know, pushed to the margins and forced into homelessness. And that sympathy has kind of diminished substantially as the tech culture, the insidious tech culture of finance people has steadily marched into the San Francisco Bay Area and gobbled up everything and pushed everyone out. These people just, you know, they think that the solution to homelessness is these technological or design solutions rather than like actually helping to fix homelessness. And then you see like some of the most egregious examples of hostile architecture have come from San Francisco. There was the thing where a church had installed some sort of a device that would spray water like every 90
minutes.
It was
like the anti-homeless robot as well.
Oh, yeah. So that was a tech solution, the anti-homeless robot that then immediately got vandalized by either some really cool local teens who we salute or some anarchist radicals, like more like the UK model, could be either. But you know, this church I think had a really egregious example. It goes to that point that Nate was making about these cleaning squads against the homeless population. They were literally spraying water like in the doorway, like the, you know, there was a little covered doorway where people were sleeping sometimes. They were spraying it like every 90 minutes or so throughout the night, so that, you know, if you were just sleeping there, you'd suddenly get dumped water on basically and have to move. And a lot of people were like, this is like inhumane in abstract. It's also just wildly inhumane for a church to be doing that. And I think the church maybe tried to claim that, like, oh, they, you know, it was some security service put this in or something, and they didn't realize that it was going to, you know, some sort of excuse like that, which you kind of raise your eyebrows at. But yeah, that this sort of like techno push is like the next frontier outside of hostile architecture, is just like making everything hostile all night using like weird robots and automated devices.
Yeah, and it sort of goes back to what I mentioned a couple episodes ago about sort of the juxtaposition of homeless encampments versus like the Uber headquarters and all of the other sort of, you know, Silicon Valley type organizations down there. And you just sort of have this conflict, and it doesn't really seem like there's these tech companies are actually coming up with any sort of productive solutions that would, I don't know, encourage investment in affordable housing for people so they wouldn't be homeless. It's more sort of just, we're going to build a robot that's going to spray water at the homeless people, and then it's going to get broken, and then we haven't solved anything. So that's sort of the issue there.
Rachel, any thoughts on any of the stuff I know I mentioned about the climate issue? I don't know if you agree with that analysis.
Oh, yeah, for sure. We go from like the teens degrees Fahrenheit to well over 100 degrees in the summer. So we are definitely not an ideal location for people who have to sleep outside or spend any extended amount of time outside. And I also just wanted to point out that in this week, we're having the Treefort Music Festival, where thousands of people kind of descend upon downtown Boise. And so there will be roving packs of teens and hipsters kind of just wandering downtown streets and gathering. And so I think I will definitely be paying attention to the architecture of how the streets are designed and how amenities are designed for people who are walking and meeting people downtown. So I'll be curious to see how people act this week, and I'll definitely be observing that.
One other thing that I wanted to talk about, which is a little bit off of the topic of hostile architecture, but is still related to some of the homelessness stuff that we've been talking about recently on the show, has been the issue of basically criminalizing feeding homeless people, like giving them food. That's been a big issue.
I think they're also going to start fining people for just panhandling and things like that.
Yeah, that's certainly been a tactic in many places. So in 2014, NPR did a thing on this, talking about this rising trend, and it's only gotten worse since then. I'll talk about a more recent article as well. But this is from a 2014 NPR report. It says, according to a report released by the National Coalition for Homeless. For the homeless, 21 cities have passed measures aimed at restricting the people who feed the homeless since January 2013. In that time, similar legislation was introduced in more than 10 cities. Combined, these measures represent a 47% increase in the number of cities that have passed or introduced legislation to restrict food sharing since the coalition last counted in 2010, the latest city at the time. To crack down was Fort Lauderdale, Florida. According to the Sun Sentinel, the city commissioners passed a measure that would require feeding sites to be more than 500 feet away from each other, with only one allowed per city block, and they have to be 500 feet from residential properties. There's also a Newsweek article from much more recently, January 2018, that talks about this sort of rising trend and cities in California actively charging people with misdemeanor offenses for, you know, a dozen people or so for feeding the homeless. Many other cities, you know, you get a ticket for doing it. And that's, again, that's not even the homeless person panhandling. That's someone trying to come in and provide food. Sometimes it's, you know, just one volunteer alone. They cite an example, 14 years old, someone got, you know, had a run-in with the police because he was trying to provide food. And they're like, can you please step aside and you know, not keep doing this or whatever. Sometimes it's just individuals, you know, providing a sandwich or whatever, but sometimes it's like organized groups that are trying to organize providing food in a more, like a more systematic way. And this has been happening all over the country. This is something that has happened in many places. 26 cities between 2013 and 2015 passed food sharing bans. And you know, they'll always cite like, oh, it's because, you know, it has to meet food preparation standards or something like that, or there's a sanitation issue or food safety issue or whatever. And a lot of times it's, I mean, not only is there no documented cases, it says, or the National Coalition for Homeless director said, told Newsweek, there's no documented cases of food poisoning coming from food that is shared from hungry people in public places. But also, like, you know, there's a lot of the food is coming from like a local restaurant or something, or it's like the donated Panera food from the day before or whatever. Like it's usually is coming from like a, you know, donations from a restaurant or something that does have to meet the food standards. So it's relatively unlikely that it's going to be a serious problem. And a total of, since from 2006 to 2017, there were 187 cities that were surveyed about various homelessness issues and sort of the legalities of dealing with that. And 6% of those 187 cities surveyed, like, outright banned the public food sharing. And so I think this is sort of another related aspect. It's not an architectural or design aspect, but like just generally like another issue that's come up a lot and been debated a lot online related to homelessness.
Wait, would that criminalize things like food, not bombs and stuff that goes out and feeds homeless people? Or
so that's the you're talking about in Boston.
Yeah, I've seen examples of it in Cambridge and things like that. So
yeah, I guess so. Like that's my understanding. I don't know what the current legal situation is around here, but that, you know, that is my current understanding, is that programs like that would tend to be affected by these ordinances.
That's also reminiscent of like ICE and like Border Patrol, like kicking over water that people have left out for migrants coming over, or I think it's actually illegal in some areas to like even leave water out on your property if potentially migrants were going to come get the water and like you knew that's the purpose for it, they could potentially charge you for that, I think.
Yeah, and that private property aspect, I mean, that's probably part of why they have that 500-foot rule in Fort Lauderdale away from residential properties. You know, on the one hand, it's just like, oh, I don't want these homeless people congregating right near my property. But on the other hand, it's also probably to block people from hosting on their own front lawn or something a food giveaway or whatever. Rachel, your closing thoughts before we wrap up here?
Yeah, as far as I know, Boise doesn't have any such ordinances against that. But our mayor Dave Beter has kind of proven to be anti-homeless and very kind of hostile to the homeless community. So it would be interesting to see if what the pushback would be if they did try to enact such an ordinance. I know our city council is very, very progressive and left compared to the mayor. So I think there would definitely be some pushback from the city council if the mayor did try to introduce such an ordinance.
All right. Well, Rachel, thank you so much for being here on the show this week.
Thank you, Bill. It's always a pleasure.
And Nate, thanks for being here in studio.
Thanks, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFD Radio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.